I'm going to ask you to try to give us a definition, Vernon, of consciousness.
All right. Consciousness is not a single term, and this is one of the difficulties people have. So, in fact, in our model, we actually refer to C matrix. And the only reason why we refer to C matrix is so people can understand we're not talking about this single definition of consciousness. Obviously, there's a neurological definition of consciousness. A person is conscious. He's fully conscious. Mm-hmm. Or he might be a bit stuporose. Or he might move all the way through to being in coma. Or another variation of consciousness may be an altered state. For example, the dreams that we have at night. Now, these are all consciousness elements that relate to the brain, to neurological functioning, and sometimes with all the residues that come through to the psychological function that is linked up with the brain. So we have consciousness at the neurological level, we have consciousness at the psychological level, but we also have potentially another kind of consciousness, a consciousness linked up with all the information that exists, but where meaning has been implied. So consciousness is information plus meaning. We call this meta-consciousness. And when we look at it in terms of meta-consciousness, suddenly this is not limited by the brain. In fact, the brain is the limiting variable. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. It's a good thing simply because the brain is able to handle certain components, but cannot necessarily handle other components. So the brain limits. For example, we don't see in the infrared or ultraviolet spectrums. We sometimes have machines that might help in that regard, or we have limited hearing because we're not overwhelmed. So this is what the brain does. It limits, but ultimately all consciousness comes through the brain, including this extended meaningful information, which we could call meta-consciousness. So fundamentally, consciousness has three important components: neurological consciousness, psychological consciousness, and consciousness in relation to extended information from all sources, which technically would not require the brain, and in fact will turn out to do so, implies infinity existing as part of this whole theory of everything.
You've talked about how Einstein and Hawking missed it, didn't get it right. Explain that.
Yeah, it's a difficult one to explain, because how can one say Einstein didn't get it right? Einstein was the greatest scientist of all, and much of our book is a sequel to what Einstein has done. In fact, we dedicate our book to four scientists, and Einstein is one of them. So to say Einstein and Hawking did not get it right is a little bit of a limitation, but they didn't get it right in terms of the fact that they ignored this simple role of extended metaconsciousness. And one cannot have a theory of everything without using extended consciousness. So, for example, Minkowski, way back in 1908, said, never again will you talk about just three dimensions of space. There are always a fourth component, time. Space and time together are inseparable. In our model, we say space, time, and consciousness are inseparable. This is what is relevant. They're inseparable. They tethered at a certain point, and yet they can spread out such that they can apparently separate, but send back information all the time to that fundamental core, which implies all sorts of different dimensions and ultimately implies not only a finite subreality, but an infinite subreality as well.
How do you fit psychic phenomena into your model?
Well, let's first of all define what we mean by psychic phenomena. Okay. I'm assuming that what you're referring to is phenomena relating to so-called psi phenomena that cannot be explained by the usual senses that we apply and by using the usual motor or muscular devices that we apply. In other words, so-called extrasensory perception, so-called psychokinesis. I use these words so-called because I don't particularly like these terms, but at the moment we're stuck with them. So that's how I'm defining your question relating to psychic phenomena. Now, how does it fit? The major component is that when you start looking at our current laws of physics, they work in 99.99% of cases. They almost always work. But the whole problem is the exception. And when you start looking at the exceptions, one of the major components that you find is that the so-called psychic phenomena do not fit that fabric. And it's not just a little bit not fit. It's a lot bit not fit. In other words, when you start looking at the data that has been generated by parapsychological research, it is truly astonishing. And it's astonishing how excellent the well-controlled studies have been. And when you start looking at them statistically, you find 9 separate areas, as I see it, of studies of psychic phenomena, 9 separate areas with probably a single base in terms of causality or in terms of origin, but 9 different areas which generate statistical significance against chance at the 1 in a billion level or above. That's 1 in 1,000 million or above. Quite astonishing. And
that comes in,
we have to say psychic phenomena very much fit into this fabric because they seem to refute or dispute or require a major alteration of our current laws of physics.
Do we know why it's there in the first place?
Do we know why psychic phenomena are there in the first place?
Yeah. Why is it around?
You know, you can throw around 2 different kinds of theories here. You can say that psychic phenomena are around because they are so fundamental. They are fundamental in the context of this extended consciousness, this metaconsciousness, which incidentally is not only something in terms of input, in terms of information as I've portrayed it, but interaction in terms of output as well. And if it's that fundamental, one may hypothesize that it is part of our life, but we are not aware of it, and we don't need to utilize it because, for example, I'm talking to you over the phone at the moment. It is far more reliable than talking to you, so to say, by telepathy. But we could argue that everyone has that. That would be one theory.
And I think everybody does have this ability. They're just not all honed in. They're not all tuned into it.
It might well be so. The other way is to say there are certain special people who, by virtue of certain patterns of brain function, have experiences which others cannot experience. So, for example, you asked me about theorist versus empiricist. And in terms of data that we have looked at, my own findings have shown that the temporal lobe of the brain is an area of the brain that seems to mediate or modulate what I call subjective paranormal experience. I'm using that term non-prejudicially, so people cannot say, well, how do you know it is real and not real?
Right.
All one can say is people have far more subjective paranormal experiences if they have a different kind of functioning of the temporal lobe of the brain. So there are 2 components. I think, as you do, that it is likely that this is a general phenomenon that everyone has to some degree, but it might not be expressed. And I think, too, that it is likely that this expresses itself in a greater way for some people compared with others.
Vernon, can it exist without the brain?
I think it can. And a model in terms of our paradigm at the moment is that it does exist without the brain. In other words, the brain is the limiting factor. And the reason why I say this is within our model, which basically says space, time, and consciousness are inseparable, they tethered together, but they spread out as well. At that spread out level, at different dimensional levels, we may see the expression of consciousness.